underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Best-selling historian Nathaniel Philbrick once again takes readers deep into the American Revolution, leading them into battles and illuminating the players on the field and behind the scenes. His latest, Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution, is a complex, controversial, and dramatic portrait of a people in crisis and the war that gave birth to a nation. The focus is on loyalty and personal integrity, evoking a Shakespearean tragedy that unfolds in the key relationship of George Washington and Benedict Arnold. Nathaniel Philbrick gives us a fresh view of America's first president and offers a surprisingly sympathetic view of the man whose name is synonymous with the word traitor. Before a live audience at the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, Connecticut, and an event with Oblong Books and Music, we welcome Nathaniel Philbrick to this week's book show. How are you?
Good. Great to be here.
Very nice to have you. What is it like to sort of be at the in New England, a little bit of the scene of the crime, if you will?
Oh, it's great. I flew in from Philadelphia last night, and we came right up the Hudson River. It was like an arrow pointed to ground zero of this book. So it's a real pleasure to be here.
Do you find that people in New England and the Mid-Atlantic states, because of the history that was born there, that when you were out, that there is more of a personal interest? Or do you get the same interest if you're in Kentucky or Nebraska or Oregon?
Well, I'll find out. I've been on the West Coast and the middle of the country, and it's been really gratifying. But I have to say, coming back, it's for me personally, I'm revisiting the places I went to in research trips in writing this book. My dad taught at Union for a year, so I lived in Schenectady. And then my dad taught in UVM before that, so I grew up also in the Lake Champlain area. So this has been a real return for me to places that were important to me growing up and were really important in researching this book.
Did you know at the beginning that this was going to be very much a book about a relationship?
Yeah, I knew I wanted to follow Washington. I had my previous book was Bunker Hill, and the last third of that follows the siege of Boston, where Washington arrives, takes over what will be the Continental Army after Bunker Hill. And this was not the Washington I grew up with. He's not the guy on the dollar bill, that staid pragmatist that sort of stares at you as if he knows everything. Washington, at the beginning of the Revolution, was in his 40s, red-haired, fiery, and by temperament, aggressive, which was a real surprise to me. So I knew I wanted to see where things led with him, but I didn't know who to pair him up with. And that's when my mother came in, because my mom was a huge fan of Benedict Arnold's when I was growing up, which says a lot about my mom. My mom was kind of a renegade, and she just had opinions. And she always said, Benedict Arnold got a bum rap. And I always said, what are you talking about? Benedict Arnold is the personification of evil. But she said, no, he was one of our best generals. He had his reasons. And I am here before you this afternoon to say Mom was pretty much right. And I realized after finishing Bunker Hill, it was time to that Benedict Arnold, I wanted to get at the other side of the Revolution. You know, we all grew up with the tradition of a band of rebel militiamen, undisciplined but full of revolutionary fervor, somehow defeated the mightiest military power on earth and thereby threw off the shackles of British tyranny. But it's a lot more complicated than that, and I realized that someone like Benedict Arnold, in pairing that with Washington, would be a way to get at that side of the story.
You present it in such a way that it doesn't excuse what he did, But it does make sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, what he ultimately did was terrible. You know, he not only turned his back on the country that he supported, but he also did it for the money. And but the fact of the matter is, in the beginning of the revolution, he was our best battlefield general, bar none. And he racked up victory after victory. You could really say he saved the country several times. And then he got overlooked for promotion. And, you know, and then other bad things happened to him. And there were plenty of officers put in a similar situation who just quit. They said, the heck with this, I'm done. This country doesn't respect those that are giving everything but their life. He hung in there, and but the cumulative pressures of the war, his own personal situation, and his character, really, because ultimately made him do what he did. But I think it's almost harder for Americans to think that he had reasons for doing it. It's much easier to think, oh, he was just evil from the beginning. But things happened, and that's what the book's about.
It's interesting because the complexity of that character, it's that same character that made him such a good general that also had him turn to ultimately become a traitor.
Yeah, I mean, he was a very passionate person. He described himself that way. And so in battle, he was all in. And the only mode he knew really was attack. And more often than not, his aggression could get him into trouble, but more often than not, it was his aggression that caught the enemy off guard and resulted in an astonishing result. And that was how he was wired. And the problem was, when he wasn't in the midst of battle, he could rub people the wrong way, particularly if you were a rival officer or a politician. But that was who he was. And, you know, he's not the only excellent general who had hard time off the battlefield. I mean, this is a recognizable type. You know, and the interesting thing is, there was a much more similarity between Washington and Arnold than I expected, because Washington was wired to be an aggressive fighter. And I think there was a part of Washington that almost envied Arnold. If Washington had been 10 years younger, not saddled with the crushing responsibility of command, and could have been out there, he could have been racking up those victories, but instead he was commander in chief and saddled with all of these problems. And you know, but that there was an essential difference. Washington was naturally by temperament aggressive, but he could control himself. He had incredible patience and integrity when it came to dealing with bad things happening to him. While Arnold was Arnold.
It is impossible to read the book and read about Congress, which during this time, during the Revolutionary War, was so incredibly dysfunctional. Thank God we fixed that. And then to have somebody who would, you know, turn on for the money. Well, you know, this all, I mean, is this just inherent in what we've kind of created here with our independence and our republic?
Well, you know, I think there is this tendency to think it was a simpler time during the founding of our nation, that these were people who were motivated by altruism, that knew what they were doing, and they made it happen. And that's not the way it happened at all. Even Washington was racked by altruistic and selfish motivations. No one knew where it was going. They were making it up as they went along. And, you know, the way that it worked out is a miracle when you look at it in process. It's only after the fact that you say, well, look at the example they have for us. Part of the point of my books is to say, hey, it's not that way at all. The past is very similar to our own time in terms of the fact that no one knows where it's going. And you know, I think there's also kind of an American side to this. This nation was born in a revolution. I mean, you know, here we have this revolution, then we have to conduct a war to ensure our independence, and they're trying to define what this republic will be. And so it's a chaotic time, but it's also extraordinarily creative time. And I think part of what makes America unique is that we have to redefine what the forefathers were trying to figure out with each generation. Because, you know, we have these ideals of everyone is created equal, but those change as we move through time. And so that each generation goes through the chaos of its own kind of revolution. It's not a pretty thing. It's not a necessarily a very efficient thing. It's a very frustrating thing. But it's the only way that what the will of the people will make its way into concrete action. And, you know, you look at where we are today, which is kind of scary at times, but versions of this are of what we've been living through with every generation.
Nathaniel Philbrick is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the book is Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. You do talk in the book, and you just alluded to this, that it was very much for American citizens were more intent on fighting with each other than they were against the British.
Yeah, I mean, and that was really one of the reasons I had to write this book, because, you know, I mentioned the myth we all grew up with, where, you know, it was, you know, us against the British. But remember, this revolution went on for 8 years. It's not as if each battle was a stepping stone to God-ordained victory at Yorktown. It wasn't experienced that way at all. In the middle 4 years, which I describe in this book, from 76 to 1780, even with the entry of France after the great victory at Saratoga, things stagnated because that alliance did nothing to really help us win the war. And as you said, Americans showed much more enthusiasm for plundering each other, fighting each other, than fighting the British. In many cases, the militia in a community became sort of the strong arm of the patriot zealots who were very intent on confiscating the homes of their loyalist-leaning neighbors. And a lot of energy goes into that. All around British-occupied New York, where it was to the north in Westchester County, you know, just below us here, was known as the neutral ground. Neither army held sway, and this left it to gangs of, if they were loyalists, they called themselves cowboys. If they were patriots, they called themselves skinners, and they would literally rape and pillage their former neighbors, confiscate what they could, and then attack again. And Westchester County became a wasteland. Most people just simply left. The fields left fallow, trees, fruit trees with apples on the branches. And then to the south, along coastal New Jersey and Long Island, it's a similar waterborne version of this occurred. Historians have called it the whaleboat wars, where, let's say, patriots who are dispossessed from Long Island are in Connecticut. They crowd into a whaleboat with all their weapons, and then they descend like Vikings on their former community and attack it and settle old scores with neighbors. You know, and this is what's going on. And it's, you know, it's happening all around, and nothing's happened. The Congress doesn't have the funds to pay for Washington's army. It looks like, you know, if somehow Washington can manage a victory and defeat the British, will there be a country left to be around at the end?
Will there be a country left in 6 months?
You know, I normally am a very pessimistic person. But I have to say, I have increasing faith in our institutions. I really do. And, you know, it doesn't take a great familiarity with history to realize how messed up it's been in previous generations. It really has. I mean, you know, in ways that are hard for us to fathom. And yes, I'm worried, but ultimately, gosh darn, we've been around for a long time. We really have, and that's the thing. You know, we're the longest lasting republic around. We're outlasting a lot of other versions of this, and knock on wood, we'll be here in a year from now saying, okay, let's see where it goes.
Let's talk a little bit about the relationship between Washington and Arnold. As you point out in the book, and as we've discussed at the very beginning of our discussion, this was a close relationship. There was great mutual trust between these two men. Talk a little bit about their meeting, about how that trust came to be, and then ultimately the transformation to great distrust.
Yeah, well, you know, Arnold was just the kind of General Washington desperately needed, where, you know, he could put him in charge of something, and it would happen, whether he sent them to Quebec on one of the most difficult journeys through the Maine wilderness, where still no one lives today. He went through there in the fall and loses a third of his men to desertion and starvation, and they stagger out of the wilderness, and he's now, Arnold is the American Hannibal. And then he has a great victory on Lake Champlain, and then there's the great victory at Saratoga. And this was the kind of person he needed, and he would focus on the job at hand. So many of Washington's generals were worried about where the revolution was going and were maneuvering for their own personal advancement. And Washington, his own adjutant general, at the darkest time of the revolution in 76, when he's forced to retreat across New Jersey, Washington opens a letter of correspondence addressed to Reed and discovers that Reed has been talking behind his back with a second-ranking general in the American Army about how awful Washington is and how he should take the reins. You know, these are the kinds of things that were happening. This was not an issue with Arnold at this point. And so when Arnold gets injured terribly, you see Washington providing, you know, real moral support. When Arnold's overlooked for promotion, Washington is, you know, says, first thing he says is, look, this is terrible, but trust me, I will do everything I can to set this right. And Arnold was always in controversy, and many of the people that were a problem to Arnold, for example, Horatio Gates, his commander at Saratoga, was also a problem for Washington. So I think Washington could really sympathize with what Arnold was experiencing, and as a consequence, it developed something of a blind spot for Washington. You know, he had a faith in him that ultimately was misplaced in the summer of 1780.
And you talk about, because Gates basically got most of the credit because of the injury that Arnold suffered, and not only physical injuries, but a great psychological bruising as well.
And Gates's role, as he was commander at Saratoga, had been Arnold's commander on Lake Champlain when he won the victory at the Battle of Valcour Island, and Gates was not an aggressive commander. He was basically a bureaucrat, and could see that Saratoga was looking to be a big victory because Gentleman Johnny Burgoyne, the commander of the British, it wasn't the American army that was the real problem, it was the wilderness. They were running out of food. The trials of maintaining a supply line to Canada proved impossible. And so this was looking like it was going to happen. But he feared that Arnold was going to steal his glory. And sure enough, after the first battle of Saratoga, the Battle of Freeman's Farm, it's Arnold's soldiers that deliver a devastating blow to the British, but Gates's official account of the battle does not mention Arnold. And Gates knows exactly what buttons to push when it comes to Arnold. They have a violent argument, and he's out of the Northern Army. And the final climactic battle, the Battle of Bemis Heights, Arnold has no official role, but that does not prevent him from appearing on the battlefield, a tremendously energetic and charismatic figure. Many soldiers will follow him everywhere he goes, and ultimately, as the sun is setting, he sees a way to end it, to take the redoubt on the British right, takes off between two lines of fire, arrives, you know, and he's full of anger, frustration, and he goes through the sally port in the back of the redoubt on his horse, raises his sword, and orders them to, to surrender. A German soldier raises his musket, fires, the musket ball fractures his thigh, kills his horse. The horse collapses on top of his injured leg. He's lying there when young Officer Henry Dearborn from New Hampshire, who's been with him since Quebec, says, "Are you badly injured?" He says, "In the leg." "I wish the musket ball had gone through my heart." And I think that kind of says it all. He, you know, there he is. Here I, you know, I'm not dead, but I'm pretty darn close to it. Look what I've done. I've had no support from my own officers. And that really begins the descent.
And that descent is fascinating to read because, as you point out, that here is a guy who had other physical injuries and was always sort of known as being brushing off things that would have killed other people.
Yeah.
But he has the fact that he's looked over, and not to mention he's being treated pretty shabbily by Congress.
Yep.
And he's starting to have money problems.
Yeah.
So these are all the seeds that are being planted
right
at this point.
There are many strands to this story. And, you know, Arnold had given much of his own personal fortune to the cause in the first years of the revolution because, you know, this whole revolution thing was because we didn't want to pay the British taxes. Well, we apparently didn't want to pay taxes to support our own army to win our independence. And so the Continental Congress couldn't tax the people directly. The states were not forthcoming with the funds required, and so they were always out of money. Arnold, in his impetuous way, gives money, then expects to get compensated. That doesn't happen. He gets overlooked for promotion. He gets really hurt at Saratoga. And you got to realize, this is a guy whose physicality is an essential part of who he was. He was a real athlete. And his leg was so bad that the doctors wanted to chop it off. He refused. He spent 4 months immobilized on a bed in Albany, his leg in the equivalent of a medieval torture device, a fracture box. It would emerge 2 inches shorter than the other leg. It would be more than a year before he could walk unassisted, 2 years before he could ride a horse. He's broke. He's angry. This is not a man who can sit still, and he has spent 4 months lying there brooding about his fate.
We are just about out of time, but I do want you to talk a little bit about the research for the book and the Clinton papers and the University of Michigan were a main source for the material, especially on Arnold.
Right. Well, you know, this all builds to Arnold marries beautiful Peggy Shippen and in Philadelphia, and she has the loyalist leanings that lead to his correspondence with Major John Andre, the British spy chief. And at the Clements Library in the campus of the University of Michigan are the Henry Clinton papers that includes that correspondence. And it is just absolutely fascinating to see these coded letters that have go back and forth. And, you know, there in my book, you can read the coded letter and the translated letter in which Arnold offers to give West Point to the British for a very good sum of money.
Wow. Nathaniel Philbrick's new book is Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. It is published by Viking. Nat, thanks so much for sharing with us.
Thank you. It's been
a great
to talk
pleasure.
To you.
Thank you very much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Special thanks to the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, Connecticut, and to our friends at Oblong Books and Music in Rhinebeck and Millerton, New York, oblongbooks.com. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.